Radio Gorgeous, the sexist station where you'll only hear the female voice.
I am going down the steps of England's first luxury hotel, the Savoy, where Winston Churchill used to bring his cabinet for lunch, and many another dignitary has stayed. Barbara Streisand, Frank Sinatra, and little old me. In any event, I am here to meet fabulous and glamorous Lucinda Riley, who, as her publicist said, has connections at the Savoy, hence why we're meeting there. We are here. We are overlooking the Thames from the secluded view of the Savoy Hotel, the American Bar. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. That's being recorded, even as we speak. Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And so, young ladies, the green olives are stuffed with anchovies.
Excellent. That's a whole. Yes, it's like a fish allergy moment.
Lovely.
Would you like to try the one?
Absolutely gorgeous.
No, just throw it in.
Exactly. No time like the present.
So my publishers are coming. I know things must be going well because you know, like last year, I don't think we even had a lunch.
Right.
And just so, and suddenly it's like, oh, you know, I sort of mentioned myself because I love this.
And ice for you, ladies. Okay.
Thank you.
And they said, yeah, let's go to the store.
Oh my God!
Wow! Fantastic. Okay. Well, let's toast to that.
Cheers.
That's what I guess. And you. I guess that's what happens when you're a best-selling author four times over.
Well, it's only just started to happen here. Yeah. And honestly, I'm so pathetic because I don't know if you've seen, but there's a poster campaign on the Underground at the moment.
I haven't seen it yet.
And it's the first time I've ever had ad shells in the UK. So 2 days ago, my husband and I were literally on the tube going round, you know, and each station sort of popping our heads out. And so I saw it twice.
You're so nice. Oh, my God.
And then various people have sort of texted me and, you know, Facebooked me.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So I'm so chuffed.
So you did in advertising terms, I think that's called riding the boards. the boards on the Circle Line. Fantastic.
Exactly. Me at Embankment. Me at Sloane Square. Me at Piccadilly.
Isn't that wonderful? And a bit surreal.
Yeah. Mm. No, it was. And I think the other thing is that because I had a career before under a different name and then disappeared into the ether when fashions changed and suddenly it was Argus and they didn't want what I was writing, and I was also having millions of babies at the time.
Yes, you had like four kids.
Yeah.
Yes.
We have seven altogether. And we have Livy as well, who is number five, so I always think of myself having five children. And so I was out in the wilderness.
Yeah.
And so I think having done a comeback, it's like so much sweeter second time around.
Yeah. Really, and really savoring it and enjoying it.
Yeah.
You know?
And also just so grateful. I'm the Gary Barlow of the literary world.
we rose and fell
together.
Yeah, but having a second act, you do. I think probably, you know, the first time round, you think, oh well, it's my due. In a certain sense, anything that's happening. And then you think, you know, whatever moment you're in, you think is going to last forever.
Yeah.
And then it doesn't. And then here you are, you're again saying, hey.
So you never, ever take anything for granted.
Yeah.
And everything is much more of a thrill than it was first time around, which I know sounds stupid. But that's because you just know it can all end tomorrow.
Exactly. It's that much more precious.
Yeah.
And also having, as you said, gone into the wilderness of having children, you know, and a lot of them, you know, having just had the one, I mean, it was, you know, getting sucked into
you've got one child,
exactly. The netherworld.
Yeah.
It, you know, being able to not only start over, but start over after, you know, a big slew of motherhood as well. That's
and
impressive.
Also, I mean, I think the other thing is that I know a lot of women really worry that they can't ever, you know, put their career back together, that it's all over for them, you know, when their little one, their last little one, in my case, was five, you know, went to school, and I suddenly thought, I have got to do something now, I have got to get back.
I have no more excuses.
although I wrote three, actually, when I was giving birth and bringing them up, because it wasn't something that I was doing because I wanted to earn money. I mean, I did want to earn money, but I just did it because I can't not do it.
I mean, so you wrote your first book at 24.
Mm-hmm.
So you've been writing.
I have
You're
been writing
a writer.
For
That's what you do.
So, yeah, and I think you are a writer forever. You may not be many things in your life. You know, all things may change, all sorts of stages, but I think, I really believe you're always a writer.
And how did you start writing that first book?
I got a bout of glandular fever really badly. I was an actress and I was in bed, and I'd always wanted to write a book because as an actress, you know, you're sort of looking at the script and thinking, why would I change that story? Mm. That's not quite the way that I would see
it. A director's nightmare, in other words.
I never said anything. I was always a good girl. I got my mouth shut. But
pretty
then,
blonde, blue-eyed, from Ireland, not saying a word.
No. Yeah,
good girl.
I just kept my mouth shut, but I always used to think I could make this better. So anyway, I just thought, right, well, I can't do anything. I'm stuck in bed, and I was really, really sick. So I just went into my imagination, and I came up with a story, and I just started writing it down, and within 2 months, I had longhand all these pages, and then a friend of mine actually read it, gave it to her father, who was a published author, and this was completely on the off chance. I mean, it didn't ask her to.
Yeah.
And he sent it to his agent.
Fantastic.
And about 6 months later, I got a 3-book deal.
Wow. That's
so
fun.
Just incredible. I mean, it just from the, you know, I mean, this is what I always think when something really bad happens to you, there is normally something very good that comes out of it.
Yeah, I think I'm a professional silver lining
hunter.
Lining
person.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
Sniff it out.
Absolutely. And I do know that when the bad things have happened in my life and they've been bad, you know, there has always been something, you know, the
that's
phoenix
come out
rising
of that.
From the ashes on whatever level. So you can, I look back on my life and I think, all right, it's not exactly been easy and perfect, but my goodness me, everything I can see now happened for a reason.
You
and
know?
I think that's so important, especially for women, to hear that, you know, you are not dead after child rearing. And you can carry on. And yes, it takes time and it takes perseverance and it's hard. I mean, when I wrote this new book under Lucinda Riley, not under my old name, I wanted it specifically to go out under my new name because I wanted to start again.
Yeah.
So nobody knew that I was me from before.
Right. Yeah.
So I was just like basically a new author, and I wanted it to be that way. I wanted to be judged on what I was doing now.
Yeah.
Not what I'd done in the past.
That's interesting. I was speaking to, I think her name, Maggie Gee's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And she won a literary prize. And no, it was anonymously judged.
Mm-hmm.
And she felt so pleased by that. So it's like,
absolutely.
you've arrived as your own daughter.
Yes.
Almost.
I wish.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, in that fresh, without the connotations, positive, negative, etc., that would come with that.
Yes.
You know, so just coming, I'm Lucinda Riley, I'm arriving here at the Savoy now.
The Rosie. But, you know, I mean, when you do look back, Donna, and I remember when I had my last publication launch, interestingly enough, with my same team, because I went back to the same publishing house, it was an absolute disaster.
Wow.
And it was one of those sort of moments that will go down in history, in my history, you know, of being absolutely dreadful.
Wow.
Because we all knew that the book wasn't going to do
what
everyone
to
had
do.
Hoped. Mm-hmm. And I, as the author, knew more than anybody else.
Yeah.
You know, so in a way, to be here today, all those years on, is just fantastic.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here sharing it with you. I'm so excited. Well, let's talk about the book, The Midnight Rose. For me, it was great because I was going away for Christmas. It is a deliciously fat, satisfying, yes, exactly. Fat,
full fat
read, you know,
nothing. You're going through a dry January, cheers.
Yes, exactly, yes, which we're not enjoying. Okay, all right, just saying. Anyway, but yeah, it took me through the Christmas holidays, which was great. You know, I had a perfect curl up and read on the plane, on the, you know, wherever I was. I can't imagine the research that's gone into this book.
Yeah. I can't imagine the research that's gone into this book. I'd have to lie down in a darkened room, actually.
Did you?
No, because I decided that I wanted to set this book in India, which was basically because my ancestors had a history there and had been out there at the turn of the century. That is, in fact, all I knew at the time about them.
Okay.
But it had always fascinated me. I think India fascinates so many people because it's such a complex, you know, messy but beautiful, spiritual, poverty-stricken, you know, set of conundrums. So I didn't know what I was letting myself in for when I started writing The Midnight Rose, because I didn't understand that it's very like Europe. In a sense, we call it India, but of course there are so many states.
Yes.
Which have completely different diets, languages, customs, religions. And so, of course, I was merrily moving the characters around India, you know, as my story told me to do. And then, of course, I got to the end of the first draft and realized that one of the characters actually needed to speak five different languages to survive in the places that I'd put him. So I had to actually
That doesn't actually work. Yeah, exactly. I was just so immersed in that world of late 1800s, early 1900s India. Just life inside palaces and what that was like, and life for women, and that these were these sort of city-states, like we think of in, you know, not too long ago in Italy, or as you say in Europe, that these loosely allied... easily broken
alliances. And in fact, not at all, you know, aligned in a lot of cases, you know, as happened when India became independent, you know, and Pakistan separated off.
What I really liked was, you know, a form of the Raj Quartet, which I can see from the back that was heavily read.
I watched all the DVDs.
Oh, God, yeah. It's
amazing.
Everything. Yeah.
I really did. Wherever I was, I'd have this sort of pack of CDs. So I literally went from a passage to India to a handful of dust. And obviously the Raj Quartet as well.
Well, because it's this incredible view both from the inside and the outside.
Well, that
you know, the Raj looking in, and but also the Indian royal families looking out.
Yeah, and I think that was actually, I don't know whether there is any other sort of European woman who has written from inside the mind, you know, of an Indian character.
Yes.
Because most of the books that we were just discussing are, of course, written from Europeans' perspective.
Yes.
Who are guests in the country, who are over there for whatever reason.
Yes.
And so this, as I said, I didn't realise what I was doing when I began.
You didn't realise what you bit off.
Exactly. Yes. And the tiny little minute detail, because I am absolutely anal. I mean, you know, a lot of people will say, oh, this is a great big page-turning book, and that's what I want to write. I want to write good stories. But having said that, there's also, you know, a massive amount of historian in me that can't bear it if I read something that is not absolutely 100% accurate. So the research I did on a minute level the book took me twice as long as I thought it was going to take.
Yeah. Well, because it's not only research into that, you know, because then, you know, it moves across generations and a century and brings us up to date. But also 1920s British country estates, sort of
my
like Downton
period.
Abbey. I mean, and where
I wrote mine first. I just
exactly. Julian, okay. Just
move
not
over, babe.
Saying. Yeah, exactly. Just not saying, I'm just saying.
Stop copying.
Ah, you'll be on to India next.
Well, actually, there was some gossip in the press, and at that point, because actually we live very near each other, so I sort of see him quite often. And at some point, I am actually going to go up and just say thank you, because, of course, the whole Downton Abbey phenomenon. We literally began at the same time. I wrote this first book, which came out at exactly the time the first series of Downton came out. So
fantastic.
Obviously, I've given Julian, you know, a bit of
inspiration.
Well,
obviously.
But it has been such a phenomenon. And, of course, I think it's very interesting that it's been quite a difficult time for everyone in the West. with the recession mm-hmm. and money problems. And so I think everybody has wanted to go back to some kind of past comfort zone.
Yes.
And have something, as you said, that you can curl up with, that feels good, that is also, I mean, because the past was so regimented, so organized, there was a sense of class structure.
Yes.
Everyone Which knew where they were.
Which definitely plays into your story.
And I think that has been comforting, mm. actually, when the future, because of, you know, the economic situation recently, has been so unstable.
Yeah.
So everyone has wanted to look back rather than forward. I mean, obviously things are getting better now, so who knows? You know, I might be in the bin again.
But we're having a good time anyway.
Exactly.
We're having a good time right exactly. now. We're being here. Be here now.
Follow us on Twitter, radio_gorgeous. Lots of love, darlings. Mwah.
But that was something that really played into the story when it moves from the 1920s forward, that it was seamless. The class structure was such that our protagonist, our early protagonist, sort of didn't even appear, because since there's no place for her, she's almost not on record.
No, exactly.
You know, she just...
Yes, well, she... You have to be one thing or the other.
Yeah, and yeah. she was neither.
And, yes, yeah. or she was a bit of both, both. And yeah. that was the problem. So yeah. So she was, Anahita is a fantastic character to write about. And out of all the characters I've ever written about, she is my favorite.
Oh, because well, even we know her as a young girl. We see her as an old woman and everything in between. And there's something so moving about her wisdom. And part of her wisdom is derived by a line of, I don't know, if would you say psychics
oh,
or
yes.
whatever,
she's
through
got
her
this
mother.
Very, very strong sixth sense.
Yes.
And
one
I mean,
that's not
parallels.
Denied.
Yep.
Yes, she does
and
not deny.
There are parallels with me, definitely.
Wonderful.
Because I live on my sixth sense. Mm. But obviously in our modern world, it's... it's decried, and you can mm-hmm. be looked at as, you know, a complete
crazy woman, person,
which is fine. So I sort of I keep
gives
that
you a little bit of
very
freedom.
Much, yeah. I keep that sort of yeah. as part of me, but I mm. don't sort of advertise it apart from on the radio. But never mind,
we're amongst friends.
Yes, exactly.
We like that. We celebrate that.
But
we
of
want
course,
to bring
if
that
you
in.
If you were living in India, especially, you know, 100 years ago, it was a massive part of your whole existence.
Yeah.
You know, the first thing that would happen to you when you were born was that, you know, a soothsayer would come in and make out your horoscope. It was all standard stuff. And, mm-hmm. you know, healers then, and the whole thing of Ayurvedic medicine, mm-hmm. which is still used in India today, which yeah. most people in India use, because sadly, mm-hmm. most of them can't afford yeah. to go to the doctor. So they look at the herbs, they look at nature, they look at what they can take that can make them better. And I'm a great believer that it's all around us.
Well,
whatever
in England
we need.
Used to be like this too. You used to, yes. Hmm. Well, Monday's child.
Well, I suppose.
Monday's child, Tuesday's child.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
We looked
but that
at that.
All disappeared.
But also, all the, you know, the pharmacy was created because people moved away from the villages where
yeah.
things, where there
where
were
we
local
would go
healers.
We would go and get some ragwort, or
yes.
we would go and get some, you know, yeah. aconite or whatever it was to make our medicines, etc.
This Industrial Revolution wasn't all it was cracked up to be.
No, absolutely.
You know,
it
tore down a lot.
And people got much sicker
yes.
in those, you know, in the terrible, terrible, dusty, smoky cities than yeah. they ever were in the country.
But yeah, so Anahita's story is wonderful also, because there's everything in there. There's romance, there's loss, there's parental loss, you know, which is a different mm-hmm. thing than losing a romantic love. There's friendship, and there's loss in friendship, and those early bonds that you
I
think
know,
are going to be so strong.
Indira,
yeah.
But no, I loved writing about that sort of childhood friendship that she has with Princess Indira, because
yeah.
I suppose it's the kind of friendship that we all aspire to have mm. as young girls. Mm. You know, our best friend.
And, yeah.
And somebody that we adore. And of course the
a
worst
A sister
thing,
by choosing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. But the problem is with the two of them is that, you know, Anahita is, if you like, the servant.
Yeah,
and
the poor relation at best. Yeah.
Yes, and yeah. that does, it has
And a girl
to
with no family and no money.
Exactly. So
hence
she
no
becomes,
prospects.
She becomes beholden, mm-hmm. and so obviously that affects their relationship as they grow older. But that beautiful moment where they lie and they're at the Durbar and they're looking up at the stars, the two of them, and holding hands, and just that perfect moment of, you know, childhood friendship that, of course, then has to be corrupted, sadly.
And even in this fabulous princess's life, some thorns must appear.
And they definitely do.
She has to sacrifice things in the end. You know. Yeah. And so then the story, what I loved is, you know, it's sort of the demise of the house.
Yes, it's what happens after Downton Abbey, in a sense.
Yes.
After the war.
Yes, when primogeniture and, you know, and tragedies. That did happen, Downton.
Yeah, and it's a very sort of metaphoric analogy, really, for what did happen, you know, especially after the Second World War, as these great stately homes were just left to rack and ruin. They were either turned into apartments or they were just left derelict because suddenly there was no staff to run them because the staff were thinking, gosh, you know, I can go and work in...
I don't have to be born into
and I can have my own freedom, my independence. And so that was actually one of the very big reasons why a lot of these houses did actually fall apart.
It's true. It's hard to get staff these days.
They couldn't find people to actually work in them. And also, obviously, the country was bankrupt after the Second World War.
I mean, everybody loves a frothy story with, you know, a movie star, you know, movie star girl, movie star boy. But these were real characters with what felt like you could imagine real problems.
Yes, you know. I wanted to, because as you say, frothy movie star Rebecca Bradley in the book, and when it opens, you immediately think, oh God, you know, I've got a sort of fake plastic Hollywood character. And in fact, what I wanted to write about, because I've been an actress, is that a sort of a false facade that the world sees, and how actually fame is the most dreadful burden.
And most also, limiting thing.
Absolutely. I don't know. And I mean, you know, on my little level, because the books are doing so well, I'm starting to do more and more interviews and PR. And of course, I guard my privacy absolutely. You know, it's the most important thing to me. And so I wanted to talk about the other side of these amazingly glamorous people and say, well, how do they have a relationship? How do they exist in the public eye?
And how can you say no to someone? And how can you, you know, how do you even have a proper breakup? How do you have a proper discussion?
Well, you can't,
how do you
have because a, you know, it's all filmed or somebody's clicking in the corner.
Yeah.
And so I just wanted to have a much more sympathetic look at, I mean, the character, I suppose, I see Rebecca, I mean, if this goes to film, Anne Hathaway, hello.
Yeah.
Perfect. She would be absolutely perfect for Rebecca.
And she'd look good as Daisy as well.
She would.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Ooh, and really,
her 1920s twin.
It's a great dual role.
Yeah.
So, and I look at her and I think, you know, she's so young. Yeah. How has she managed it?
Yeah.
How has she managed to sustain any kind of normality in her life? Because it is impossible. And what's interesting is that, especially in the UK, everyone seems to be hunting for fame non-stop. That seems to be the sort of golden fleece. It's not about what you've done to earn it. It's about becoming famous.
Yeah, it's for its own sake.
So this is a sort of bit of a parable, I suppose, in a way. Just to say, don't, you know, be careful what you wish for.
Yeah.
Because the last
there
thing
is this sting in the tail.
I want my books to become famous. Of course I do. But I don't want to become famous. I want to hide behind them.
Yeah.
Because I also think it's very important, you know, the mystique of an author. Nobody wants to know, and this is where I have a proper answer on Twitter and Facebook, nobody wants to know what I've had for breakfast, surely, or, you
well,
know,
Well, I'm enjoying the...
Well, exactly. Yes, I'll tell everybody where we
all
are
All you
now.
Do is rosé.
Yeah. And the Savoy.
Rosé from... Exactly, from head to toe.
But, you know, I don't think when you are creating a set of characters that you, the author, should really be too obvious or out there.
Well, that's what I've found wonderful about you, because it is a very far-reaching story across, you know, time, place, generations, genders. It must be your actress head.
Well, possibly.
That gets in there.
I mean, I actually don't know, to be fair, Donna, where these stories come from. Because I don't, you wouldn't believe this, but I do not and did not write down a single word of plot from that book.
Really?
So everything's held in my head.
It just comes somewhere.
Yeah, and I dictate as well because I have, I'm an ex dancer as well, so I have very bad RSI.
Right.
And so I can't sit at a computer all day. So I have Dick, my best friend Dick. And Dick and I wander around the garden and I walk because I think better when I'm on the move.
Yeah. You're a movement person.
Yeah, I am. I can't sit at a desk. It's too much like work. And this sounds really weird, but it's almost as though I'm channeling these stories. And just to finish off, I have to tell you something that I said at the beginning that my ancestors had been in India. And anyway, I knew that there was a photo album somewhere in my mother's house. And I'd never seen it because my great aunt, who kept it, had just died. And my mother had cleared out the house. So I'd never seen this. I swear to you, I'd never seen it. But I did know about it. And I said, you know, Mummy, can you find this photo album? And she's very flaky. And so, you know, nine months went by. And anyway, I'd actually got to the end of this book. Finished it, and I was sort of pacing or whatever I was doing at the time, and my entire family happened to be there, and Olivia, my PA, came in and said, Lulu, I really think you should just come into the office now to see something. So I'm like, okay. So I walk in, and you know when you walk in, you know, it's a bit like being burgled, and everyone knows you've been burgled except you, which has happened to
something's,
you before.
What's
and my entire family are all standing there looking at me. And so I'm led to the sofa and sat down by my husband. And Livy, Miss Non-Believer in anything like this, actually says, right, I think you better look. This is the photo album. And I started to open the pages, and the first picture was of the Delhi Durba.
Oh, my God.
And as I go through, I find Donald, Daisy, and Maud.
Oh my God, my hair is just
and I swear
wrinkled in the back of my head.
And everyone knew in that room that I had never ever set eyes on that photo album. Nobody knew, not even my mother, the names of the characters, because it's not something that
we would talk about over dinner or something. Yeah,
it was 100 years ago. And anyway, and then two weeks ago, did you just burst into tears? I cried. I was just like, oh my God, how? And of course,
there's something bigger than me.
Yeah, my non-believing, cynical family who look at me as a bit of a sort of, you know, up there with the fairies type person. Yeah, exactly. Suddenly, all of them are like, oh my God. Yeah, so it was a little bit of a
validation. Yes, exactly.
Thank you. Not that I meant that. But then 2 weeks ago, just the final thing that happened was that there was a photo of my parents' house. Sorry, not my parents, my ancestors. So my great-grandfather's house when they came back in 1921 to the UK. And I'd seen it, obviously, since I've had the photo album on millions of occasions. And it's underneath, it said, our home in the UK, Crapstone. Now, for some reason, I thought that just sounded like it was Kent. I don't know why. Anyway, last week I got Olivia to actually, I said, look, shall we find out where this is? Mm-hmm. You're never going to believe where it was. It's on the edge of Dartmoor.
No. No.
Seriously. Oh my God, I thought she was joking when she told me. She read it out.
Like, you're just doing that to, like, you know, because you know what I'm like.
Yes! She said, no, look, it's on the edge of Dartmoor, I promise you. And I had to go and see it. And I was, I think, out of all of the things. Because I thought, okay, we have the Indian connection. But
to
for
then
them
have the
to live on the edge of Dartmoor in their English house. I mean, it was just incredible. So, of course, there is something...
So you were fated to write this story, and
absolutely.
We are fated to read it.
Well, I do.
Oh, Cinderella, thank you so much.
Well, thank
it's been
you,
such
Donna.
A pleasure. Good luck with everything. Have a ball at the launch.
I will.
Have a whale of a time because you deserve it.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Get in contact with us, contact us on info@RadioGorgeous.com, and to sign up for our shows to come once a week into your inbox. Who can think of anything better, darling?